Thank you, Chuck, and thank you all for coming out this morning so early. Those of you who are not in this time zone, I know it must feel very, very early. I am not in this time zone, so we'll see how I make it through the next few moments. My expertise mostly consists of muddying the waters, complicating the situation, trying to throw some idea grenades out into the room to see how much damage I can make. I'm going to range very widely over a number of examples. I have a lot of questions to raise. Some ideas to share with you, no answers, no definitive answers anyway. I hope maybe we'll be able to come up with a few ideas and answers during our discussions, but at the very least, I think we need to start with a good look at some of the complications because our answers are only as good as the questions we ask. And I fear, as someone who spent many, many years as a faculty member, corrupting young minds on a daily basis, one at a time, that the questions we're asking about assessment, you know, how do we know we're doing what we say we're doing, that those questions are not rich enough, they're not complex enough. And so I want to try to complicate things for you a little bit this morning. I want to start out with what I think is perhaps the most complicated situation of all, which is, what is it that happens when we learn? What is that like? Chris Deedy is at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and it was 2 years ago at the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative annual meeting that he spoke on some of the things he's doing with his group at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. There was a moment in that talk, which I have since grabbed, cut out, and remixed myself, that was electrifying. And it began with a real sit-up, I'm not taking my nap anymore, statement. Our assumptions about learning are fundamentally flawed. What I want to do is play for you what Chris Deedy said at that moment. Was anybody here for that, by the way? Yeah, a couple of you? Okay. It won't hurt to hear this again. This, I think, is a statement of the problematics that we're having to look at and we should be confronting when we think about assessment.
Our assumptions about learning are fundamentally flawed. I want to describe three kinds of common human behaviors and put them on a continuum from simple to complex: sleeping, eating, and bonding. People are pretty much alike in the way that they sleep. If you're designing hotel rooms, it's pretty easy to create a hotel room that works for anybody across any culture in terms of what they need to sleep. Eating is much more variable. People like to eat very different things, and they like to eat them in very different ways. They like the eating experience to be quite different. So if you're designing a restaurant, not just the architecture, but the menu and the style of dining that goes on, there's incredible variety. Bonding is more complex still. People bond to pets. People bond to sports teams. People bond to people who are like them, who are opposite to them. They bond sexually. They bond platonically. They bond to groups. People who study bonding are struck by how incredibly rich and varied it is. We treat learning like sleeping. But everything we know about learning suggests that it's like bonding, or at least like eating. And yet the very, very best of our high-end learning environments have less variety than a bad fast food restaurant.
And as a sidebar, I have just friended Chris Deedy on Facebook and told him that I would be happy to pay him royalties for using this as many times as I have. And he said, no, thanks. Glad the ideas were helpful. Interesting. Scholarly communication, Facebook, friend groups, just saying, could be. So if we treat learning like sleeping, we treat assessing learning like sleeping. Something like the little customer satisfaction survey that you fill out at the end of your stay. Was everything all right, sir? Everything all right, ma'am? Etc. If learning is really like bonding, our assessment ought to be driven by that. Our assessment techniques should be enhancing that experience for our students, for our faculty, for our staff. We should be thinking in terms of relationships. We should be thinking in terms of the way people form strong, cognitive, affective bonds with each other. But I suspect that it's more like sleeping and not even quite up to the fast food level. This distorts our experience of trying to make our processes better. And I have to go to Shakespeare to get at the tragedy of the situation. This is an illustration from Othello. Othello was big on assessment, if you remember the plot. He wanted to make sure that his wife was faithful to him. Iago had sown doubts in his mind that perhaps Desdemona was not what she ought to be, but Othello was an evidence-based practitioner. He wanted ocular proof. He wanted to make sure that he wasn't flying off the handle, that he really had the goods on his wife. Well, you know how the story turns out. He got his ocular proof, but it was faked. It wasn't real. The real issue here was trust, not evidence-based assessment. The real issue here was bonding. It was not trying to find some piece of hard data that would steer his actions. The moral here is clear. You find what you're looking for. We get caught up in evidence-based assessment, and evidence is good. I'm not a scientist, but I understand enough about science to know that many anecdotes do not add up to data. However, if what you're trying to gather data on is bonding, and what you demand is the kind of proof that an Othello might demand, you're going to be in trouble. This is a book that has meant a great deal to me over the last few months since I've picked it up. Jonathan Kozol's Letters to a Young Teacher. Have any of you read this book? Okay. If you haven't, I urge you to put it on your list because it's a great snapshot of just what K through 12 teachers are facing these days in a culture of assessment that makes even the worst cultures of assessment in higher education look fairly benign by comparison. If any of you have taught high school, if any of you know high school teachers, if some of you are teaching high school at this time, you know what I mean. And I want to share with you something very heartfelt and very moving from what Jonathan Kozol writes to this young teacher about the culture of assessment, evidence-based assessment, that she's up against. "There's a final point you raised in your last letter," Kozol writes. "A blasphemous point, given the views that are ascendant now in Washington and in most state capitals. This is the whole business of the intellectual authority that is attributed by many of the high officials in our urban schools to the entire body of materials that are being turned out by the standard writers and technicians of accountability. Most of these materials," Kozol continues, "as you slyly surmised, are written not by seriously respected scholars or by wise and venerated teachers, but by fairly undistinguished semi-intellectuals who would seldom qualify for tenure at a first-rate university. The clunkety prose, the reliance upon arbitrary overstatement, and the seemingly obsessive need to fit all pieces of the learning process into nameable compartments are not the characteristics of capacious intellectuals. Wise philosophers, good scientists or poets, gifted mathematicians, accomplished literary critics, or reputable specialists in children's psychological development would not likely be disposed to spend long hours of their time in numbering and naming isolated particles of balkanized cognition that usually have only forced connections with each other and, most often, no connection with the context of our children's lives. Standards compilations tend to be, exactly as you stated it, quote, the products of the dutiful but uninspired," end quote. This is the context, this is the technicians of accountability context out of which the students come when they arrive at our colleges and universities. And we need to be very careful, I think, about the way we design our own assessments, about the way we think about assessment, so that we don't plug into what students have grown to expect by the time they get to higher ed. We have to be very, very careful not to be as narrow, as dutiful, and as uninspired as the technicians of accountability are who are driving K through 12. And in fact, if we set a good example, we might have some authority, some power to change that particular culture. So some more Shakespeare. "The danger of quantitative evaluations. They're absolutely necessary, of course. Where would we be without the Likert scale? Where is Mr. Likert? I'd like to shake his hand. And yet, we all know about survey fatigue. We know about survey fatigue writ large. And we know about the things that can't be quantified so easily, things that can be demonstrated, but perhaps not measured along that Likert scale. Here's a tragedy from Shakespeare about the dangers of quantitative evaluations. This is King Lear asking his daughters, "Which of you, shall we say, doth love us most?" And you know what? The daughters, they work to the test. except for Cordelia, who then gets banished and tragedy ensues. But the moral is clear. Once again, if you're dealing with a human context as rich, as varied, as complex as bonding, if you ask the wrong kind of question, you're not only going to get a meaningless answer, you can get a very dangerous answer. And lest you think that I'm being a little too exaggerated here, this is Inside Higher Ed, January 13th, 2009. The headline is Faculty Pay by Applause Meter. And this is about Texas A&M deciding to run a pilot program in which they're going to give up to $10,000 in bonuses to professors who score well on student evaluations. Now, I am very happy, and I've got the whole comment stream here to keep me happy, that there was an immediate outcry about this, including, and this is important, and as a humanities guy, I want to say I support science. There were scientific objections. Actually, the chancellor at Texas A&M was using the wrong kind of evidence, was misreading the argument that had been made in the article he cited, etc. And yet, how easily we slip into this. Can't we just find the direct measure? Isn't this about customer satisfaction? The customer idea really, really bothers me, said Clint McGill, a genetics professor who's speaker of the Faculty Senate at College Station. You can't buy the grade or the degree, so how can we be the same as a consumer thing? It's like saying, if you give us professors this much, you get your grade. If we have any principles at all, it doesn't work that way. And the disaster is not just the professors who don't get the raise. The disaster is that the fundamental assumptions that we demonstrate about learning are flawed. Flawed disastrously. Flawed tragically. And people are still trying to do this. People are still trying to say, essentially, which of you, shall we say, doth love us most? Love is not the operant word in that context. It's something else. We need to find a way to deal with uncertainties. We need to deal with things that are readily experienced, but not easily articulated. Shakespeare knew about this as well. This is a scene from A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a wonderful play about dreaming and love. One of the most wonderful things, and my students always pick up on this, is that one of the lovers never recovers from the drug, is never given the antidote, and yet lives his dreaming life in perfect happiness. That seems to work out too. The point is this. If we're trying to figure out what's real, if we're trying to figure out what's authentic, we should be a little playful. We should be a little humble. We should be a little experimental. We should always be careful to ask ourselves the question as we put our assessments together, looking at the first three letters of the word assessment. Am I an ass? And if I am I in love? Is that okay? To deal with these uncertainties, to deal with these unknowabilities, keeps us humble, keeps us, I think, playful, keeps us bonding to each other. We don't look to each other for definitive answers. We look to each other for ideas. A book that has completely humbled and inspired me over the last couple of months is this book called Falling for Science, Objects in Mind. Have any of you picked that book up? It's an astonishing book. It's a book about assessment. Sherry Turkle, who's a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, asked her students over decades, what object got you interested in science? What was the thing that made your mind go click? And thing is an important word here because the object turns out to be of vital importance. It's a way to mediate the external world to the internal life. And she got a rich, fascinating set of essays. We might call them a longitudinal assessment, in which students over many, many years thought about, dreamed about, wrote about what objects inspired them to become scientists. She also asked some scientists, including the president of MIT, to reflect back on their own lives and what objects got them interested in science, got them to fall for science. I want to share a couple of them with you. One is a fellow named Seymour Papert, who's someone who will be familiar to many of you. And he talks about loving gears. It was just gears. When he was 2 years old, he first got exposed to gears. Just the little objects, the ones you can see upon the illustration there. And from that, an entire life of inquiry, an entire life of rich intellectual activity emerged. And he says, first, I remember that no one told me to learn about gears. No curriculum. Now, that's scary. We put our curriculum together in a very deliberate way. But some part of this learning activity always emerges from the learner because of, sometimes in spite of, what we've assembled. Papert goes on, second, I remember that there was feeling, love, and he's emphasized those in the text, as well as understanding in my relationship with gears. There was a powerful affective component. Third, I remember that my first encounter with them was in my second year. And then he writes, if any scientific educational psychologist had tried to measure the effects of this encounter, he would probably have failed. It had profound consequences, but I conjecture only very many years later, a pre- and post-test at age 2 would have missed them. End quote. And in her epilogue, which is very fruitfully and aptly entitled, What Inspires, Turkle writes, quote, we cannot know whether we stand before a child who will use objects as a path to science, and we cannot know to which objects a child will be drawn. The memoirs in this collection teach the importance of acknowledging and accommodating such uncertainties. A one-kind-fits-all curriculum is likely to take children away from the objects that compel them. And I would say that a one-kind-fits-all mode of assessment is going to ensure that we miss the richest opportunities for bonding, for the deepest kind of learning. So how can Web 2.0 be of any help in this situation? Well, I think it has at least some conceptual frameworks that can help us formulate better questions and perhaps generate better ideas when it comes to assessment. Because Web 2.0 is something that emerged. Nobody invented Web 2.0. It's not in a box with shrink wrap around it. It's not a product. It was a set of trends identified by someone, Tim O'Reilly in this case, with enough persuasiveness, with enough conceptual richness and integrity, that everybody said, yeah, I guess we are looking at a different kind of an experience on the web. And I want to suggest that a lot of rich assessment techniques could come out of this particular strategy as well. Look around, look at what's being demonstrated, look at what's emerging, and try to draw lessons from that, try to draw concepts from that, rather than starting with a bucket of a priori's and then forcing the circumstances to fit. O'Reilly names 7 or 8, depending on which page you go to, characteristics of Web 2.0, but there are 4 I want to boil it down to today and think about in terms of assessment. One is the idea of user-generated content. In Web 1.0, you went to the page, somebody had prepared the page, you took in the page, the transaction was over. In Web 2.0, you go to a page and you expect to see the stuff the readers have left there. In fact, the readers have helped to write that page. So the idea is that user-generated content makes the web much more richly interactive and helps us co-create the web. Very powerful idea. No one woke up one morning and said, well, now we will do this on the web. It emerged out of a set of practices as people were in that experience. Another characteristic that's going to be, I think, an interesting one to think about with regard to assessment is the idea of network effects. This is good news. It means that you can scale, but you can only scale at the point of, in the case of the web, the reader, in the case of institutions of higher learning, the student. You can't scale an institution, you can scale the participants. Network effects mean that the more you have in the mix, the richer the experience is going to be. I think there are ways to harness that for assessment. The idea of the long tail is very, very important for Web 2.0, that much value emerges slowly over time. And for that emergence to happen, you need to be able to get at that emergence over time. You need to be able to see it. You need to be able to search for it. You need to be able to experience it so that once the initial phase of a program or a curricular change or any kind of institutional adjustment happens, you'll be able to see the effects ripple out over time and they'll be meaningful. You can have access to them as a community. And then finally, maybe the scariest one of all, although we don't really notice it much in the web, is perpetual beta. All the really cool stuff on the web is perpetual beta, meaning subject to improvement at any time. Meaning it's not a contract, it's a starting place. When I put my syllabi together, I always put the word beta after the word syllabus. The idea that a syllabus is a contract, it seems to me, is anathema to the idea of a learning experience. But I hear people talking about it. You better have your learning objectives there. My students are coming up with their learning objectives in class today. That's their assignment. We've been through the introduction. They've done some introductory readings. Now, what are the learning objectives? They will be yours. I have ideas in mind as well. I've expressed that to them. But they will be writing their own, and they'll be on the syllabus, the beta syllabus. But as I say, that's a little frightening because it means that all the targets are moving. Well, of course they are. Anybody been in a relationship before? Of course they are. The relationship changes the people in the relationship. Oh dear, what are you going to do if you adjust to your spouse and your spouse has adjusted to you and now you have to adjust to the adjustment? You work at it. So let's think about these just to get maybe some of the creative juices flowing. What about user-generated content? Have you been to Amazon.com lately? Probably a number of you have. There's information there about the product. But there's a huge amount of information there about the experience of the product, about what folks have been doing in terms of looking at other products, in terms of whether folks think that this is a good product or a bad product. You can very easily see all the one stars, all the five stars. It's all right there for you. If you think about that model, and you think about something like RateMyProfessor.com, which is a dismal site in many respects, what if we had some assessment interest that was like RateMyProfessor.com, done right, done along the lines of Amazon.com, with all of the data there? Students who took this class tended to do well in these classes. Students who took this class tended to take these other classes afterwards. Students who earned a grade of A in Dr. Campbell's class later went on, et cetera, et cetera. You could make this anonymous. You could make this simply quantitative. You could open up a space for user-generated comments. There are any number of ways you could think about doing this. The idea is to create a community in which the activity is visible, in which people believe that they are significant in their contributions. I don't think it would be that difficult to think of a way to do this. In fact, as the comment stream went on that Inside Higher Ed article, which was the inspiration for me putting this up here, one of the respondents said, well, look, we figured out how to do this kind of rating thing in e-commerce in an interesting way. It's not just about pushing a product. Can't we think of some way to do that with our students? And I think, yeah, maybe so, especially if they stayed up course after course after course, year after year after year. That would be very interesting. I'd find it helpful as an instructor. I don't find Rate My Professor terribly helpful. Tends to be either love or hate, right? And the occasional chili pepper, although I think I've aged out of the chili pepper demographic. Sigh. Yeah. Think about Wikipedia. All right, Wikipedia, the thing that will never work in theory. It will only work in practice. When Wikipedia first came out, it was limited only to anointed experts. Nothing happened. Then it was thrown open to the world. Then lots of things happened. But when you look at Wikipedia, look at it carefully. Look at the way the community presents itself. Look at the discussion page. Look at the user pages where the people who've contributed to the discussion have accumulated a lot of interaction on their own. Think about what that might be like if we had pages for our best teachers. I have long thought, and I may yet do, as a project, a Wikipedia for my most beloved teachers. And have them up there and start to flesh out the biographies of these people who have been so notable to me and invite other people who've had these teachers to contribute their testimonials. We have testimonials on Flickr, for crying out loud. What about a little appreciative inquiry in a collection of rich layered narratives of outstanding teaching. Whether I made it into that Wikipedia or not, sure, I'd love to, but whether I made it in or not, how inspiring would it be to go read that stuff, to find out over many decades how these teachers have made a difference in students' lives? We could do that. Putting it together technically is a trivial exercise. And putting it in the context of appreciative inquiry, it seems to me, would be an assessment technique that would not only drive improvement internally, but would be a startling demonstration to the world of the magic that happens in these institutions they support. Facebook? Been on Facebook lately? Seen the way it organizes itself around years of graduation? Around people? It's probably the most effective alumni association in the world right now. Who would have thought it? Which is another takeaway here. Look for the counterintuitive. Where are the people who are self-organizing into birds of a feather, who are self-organizing into rich, shared reflections on their experience? Just these three examples, it seems to me, have tremendous implications for assessment, but only if they are understood in their complexity. If you read Amazon, Wikipedia, or Facebook superficially, you might as well go back to the Likert scale. Now, what about network effects? Again, you'll hear me talk about this several times. What about a lifelong learning online environment? Well, how would you do that? Who has the resources for it? Our faculty already have no time. Our students are all working. We don't have the staff to cover it. Well, set it up and see what happens. You might be surprised. This is a little discussion group with a free open source platform called PHPBB, which I set up for a class last spring, back when I was at the University of Mary Washington. And the strangest thing happened. All I did was say post a couple of times a week, post something about class, which they did, and they would bring up topics, they would bring up various ideas to discuss. And then one of the students, a roguish fellow, started this little thread, a little place to sit, he called it. I figured it would be nice to have a topic just to discuss your own thoughts and feeling about life. We're a class, of course, that is very true. However, we can have our own doubleness and be a fellowship of scholars and awesome people reaching for similar stars. No, this is not quite the Fellowship of the Ring, sorry. Will this get response? Who knows? However, I was smacked and told, reinforce your learning. I didn't literally smack him, but I said that over and over. Post to the forum, reinforce your learning. Do you ever feel things we discuss in class or materials we read affect your day-to-day life in some way? If so, how? And then the next poster, hell's bells, our readings affect my day-to-day life, my view of the world has shifted totally, etc. I believe our students would like a place to go on being in their best classes after they've graduated. The trick is going to be how we construct the environment. They chose their avatars. They chose their usernames. This is the kind of forum that exists aplenty on the internet. This is where these students are hanging out, discussing everything from fan fiction to the latest episode of House. It isn't a learning management system. It doesn't look like a learning management system. It looks like a clubhouse. It looks like a place to hang out together. It looks a little like the knot of people who are discussing things after class. To my shock and to my great glee, several students kept posting to this forum long after the class was over. They did their summer reading lists, shared them on this forum. Grades were in, class was done, credit was earned. Why would they keep doing this? It wasn't because of me, it was because this was their space, and because it was a playful space, because it was a performative space, because it was a space that reminded them of a good experience they'd had in a class, and they wanted to keep that going. A friend of mine who teaches at the University of Richmond has a question that he likes to ask people when he's doing teaching workshops. What would you like your students to say as they leave your classroom on the last day? If you could be a fly on the wall and hear what they say, what would you want to hear? And when he asked that question, I knew immediately what I wanted to hear, which is I wanted to hear the students say, let's keep this going. It seems to me if we can build an environment, associate it with what's best about our own institutions, a place where they can keep this going. We're going to get a lot of assessment data out of that. And we're going to get a lot of bonding as well. Along those same lines, we need to build a place to catch the time, a place where students are able to interact over time, shaped by various kinds of rich, ongoing experiences. This is a blog post that I put up. I don't remember the date. I guess it was probably 2006. Can't remember. Why do I blog? Well, why does anybody blog? Why would anybody want to communicate with anybody? It's just my letter to the world, letter to me, just my blog, that's all. What happened when I blogged about this Paradise Lost readathon, though, was startling to me. A student from 7 years prior found the post, commented. A student from 6 years before found the post, commented. They found each other as well, coming outside the containers of our courses and being able to interact over time across courses, across generations. This particular aspect is located in a site of my own professional practice. But I didn't put it together for that reason. I put it together for me. But it turns out that because we are social animals and because we like to learn from each other, if it's emerging from some sense of authentic self and authentic practice, people will be drawn to it. I don't have anything there for perpetual beta because that's a blank slate. When you think about assessments, when you think about what constitutes authentic learning, when you think about how to measure that or how to get at it or what questions to ask, you always need to have a blank slate and a blue sky and never, ever believe that you've located the final answer. Because if learning is about bonding, you're not going to find the final answer. You're going to find lots of interesting ways to be in community, but you're not going to find the final answer. And last but not least, there is no silver bullet. And here's another unlikely source that I want to share with you. One of my favorite books, this is The Mythical Man Month. Have any of you read this book? Yeah, okay. Project managers, I guess, right? The Mythical Man Month. Frederick P. Brooks wrote it. It's partially about his experience as lead programmer, lead designer for the IBM 360 operating system in the 1960s. But it really is about being in community together, trying to work together. And even more than that, because it's about software engineering, I think it has some very powerful analogies with what we do when we think about education. I want to explore those a little bit. There's the cover for you. I'm a big analogy guy. Chuck knows I love metaphor. It was one of the ways that Chuck and I bonded immediately. We both had the word metaphor in our presentations, and we said, oh, this is like... No, just kidding. So when Brooks discusses software engineering, what I do with my little analogy technique is to pop out the word software engineering and pop in the word learning or education. And Brooks identifies four difficulties with software engineering, four questions, vexed kinds of questions, that mean we're never going to have a silver bullet. We're never going to come to the automatic, all-singing, all-dancing software engineering producing machine. It's not going to happen. Just as I think we're never going to get to a model of computer-aided instruction, computer-aided assessment, or any kind of educational affordance that's going to be the ultimate answer that's going to produce automagically just exactly what we need. He talks about the way in which software engineering is complex, and he says it's all about the nonlinear interaction and near infinite states because it's about combinations, because it's about ways in which things are going to be drawn to each other or repel each other in certain ways. You can't map all the complexity. I think education is like that. In fact, it's what we say we want. We want our students to make connections, connections that emerge from their own thought, from their own experience. If we make the connections for them, they're not theirs. Brooks talks about conformity as a feature of software, that it exists within many shaping contexts. Just so our students The lives they live are rich and complicated. The relationships they're forming with their roommates, with their new significant others, with their parents, these are very complicated. And when we try to assess what's happening in terms of education, we have this as a factor impinging upon what we're trying to measure as well. Brooks talks about the changeability of software and says that it's pure thought stuff, which I love because that's exactly what we're doing in education. It's pure thought stuff. I can't think of anything that's more immediately meta than education itself, where we're thinking about thinking, learning about learning constantly. In fact, we'd better be, or else we're just stamping out the robots. We're not equipping learners for the lives they're going to live. And then finally, he says that software is difficult to visualize and represent. And I love this. The reality of software is not inherently embedded in space. Hence, it has no ready geometric representation in the way that land has maps, which I think is true. But one of the things that makes Web 2.0 so fascinating for me in teaching and in thinking about assessment is that you can't make a map of Web 2.0, but you can make a collage, you can represent it, you can see that there is a network there. And when you look at something like that, though you're not seeing a clear path from point A to point B, you're not seeing a kind of magic 3D thing out of which the answer is going to emerge, you are seeing variety, you are seeing potential relationship, you're seeing a field for play, a field for work, a field out of which meaningful experience can come, because these things emerged from the desire for meaningful experience. So if Web 2.0 is about human beings trying to think together, trying to augment human intellect together, sometimes more altruistically than others, I think that we can look at specific examples of Web 2.0, but especially the idea of Web 2.0 as a rich way of thinking about how we're going to get at some of the complexities, some of the bonding, some of the possibilities, some of the potential in an authentic way when we think about assessment in higher ed. Thanks for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Or no, I won't answer them, but I'd be happy to attend to any questions that you have.
Good job. Thanks.